I don't think business executives, I don't think we as people yet have fully embraced what we need to do. There's an expression that things take longer than you think they should and then move faster than you think they could. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen here.
Hi, I'm Alana Weston, chairman of Selfridges Group. Welcome to How to Lead a Sustainable Business, the podcast where I speak to the pioneers who are driving us towards a greener future. Today, you'll hear my conversation with one of the leaders in sustainable investing, David Blood. David is co-founder and senior partner of Generation Investment Management, which he founded in 2004, along with Vice President Al Gore. In his first meeting with Gore, the pair realized their individual interests were two sides of the same coin, with Gore's passion for environmental advocacy and Blood's focus on poverty and inequality. As a result, Generation's mission seeks to unify thinking about social and environmental impact into one movement and develop a more holistic view of market and individual company practices. The first thing I wanted to ask David was about his personal story and how that changed his perspective on the world at a very young age.
Well, I moved to Brazil when I was 10 years old. And my parents will tell you that that is really where my sense of social justice was developed. We lived in a house in São Paulo that overlooked a favela. And every morning, I would have my breakfast and I would look out, and basically maybe 10 meters away was a young boy my age having his breakfast, except he was outside in a sort of a one-room shack. And I kept asking my parents, well, why is it that I live here and he lives there? And of course, they couldn't answer that question. And then another trip to Brazil, we saw just terrible poverty. And Brazil, beautiful, beautiful country, and is really a second home to me. But those experiences clearly affected how I thought about people, how I thought about what's fair, and certainly social justice.
Tell me a little bit about when you started, when you first become involved in responsible investment. Tell me the story of Generation.
Well, I retired from Goldman Sachs in 2003, principally because I felt like I had accomplished what I wanted to accomplish, but I also recognized that there were some challenges in the investment industry. One was the market was very short-term oriented. And secondly, the market hadn't quite, appreciated the opportunities and challenges of sustainability. And people were undervaluing the signals of environmental and social governance factors. And so when we founded the firm, we did so with the expectation that we would be better fund managers. We would deliver better results for our clients. And in fact, we've always said, we're not trading values for value. We think that this is a superior, more robust business model and investment framework. So we actually never thought it was responsible investing. We actually thought it was best practice investing. And our mission was to help bring sustainability and ESG into the mainstream. We're delighted to hear that others have now decided that sustainability and ESG are our mainstream. And the reason why it has increasingly been accepted as basically smart investing or smart business is the business case is robust.
So just if you could expand on that point, because I'm quite interested in the difference between balancing sustainability and profit with aligning the two, because I think they're both two slightly different approaches.
Well, I think you're right, actually. And one of the challenges is that people assume that sustainability and ESG is always a win-win. It's not. There can be trade-offs, and it's important to recognize what those trade-offs can be. But taking a step back, for us, from an investment perspective, but also I think you could argue that you could flip it around as from a business framework, we have always thought about our philosophy to be based on three core points. The first is long-term business or long-term investing is best practice. Second, and crucially, sustainability is a current and future driver of economies. Now, we define sustainability quite broadly to include issues like climate change and the environment, but also equality, poverty, social justice, health challenges, migration challenges, governance challenges, diversity challenges. And all of these are issues that are interlinked and drive economies. And it's critical, both from an investment and a business perspective, to understand those issues and how they interact on the business and economies. And then thirdly, environmental and social governance factors are drivers of business success and therefore should be analyzed in understanding what a company does and how a company does it. And so that framework helps identify what we think are best-in-class businesses and best-in-class industries and allows us to assess ultimately where we want to deploy capital. But when we're doing that, we recognize there's going to be some trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, if you have a business that is extremely good on the environment and it's driving the transition to a no-carbon economy, but treat their employees terribly or have terrible governance or are not operating appropriately in their community, then is that a good company? I'm not so sure. I think, in fact, you need to be holistic and understand how all of these factors work together to drive a long-term sustainable economy. You can be very focused on climate and the climate emergency, but if we do not fundamentally understand that climate and the environment are really the same coin of social justice and equality and opportunity and addressing poverty, if we don't understand that, then we will not achieve what we want to achieve on climate. And in fact, we would say that the highest priority has to be a just transition. If we give up or if we forget about people in these sorts of conversations, we will never get to where we need to get to.
So just stepping back a bit, when you went out to raise money, did people think you were crazy or did they think you were just niche? Or what was it like doing those first pitches?
I think they thought we were crazy, actually. And actually, we found it harder in the United States than outside the United States. Europeans and Australians had heard the word sustainability and ESG and didn't immediately lock us out. They were happy to hear the business argument. And we did have the credibility of folks who'd been doing investing for a long while, and that certainly helped. In other places, the words sustainability and ESG are considered political words. And I honestly thought that oftentimes when we would do a presentation, the folks on the other side of the table were just imagining our investment committee meetings where we would be singing Kumbaya, holding hands, and then saying, yes, this is the right decision. And in fact, that's how we started out. And that's, but we've gotten a little more sophisticated since that time. But all kidding aside, the business framework of long-term investing, of sustainability-driving economies, and ESG as tools to understand what a company does and how a company does it, this framework is extremely robust. And as we've said that over 16 years, increasingly people say, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. This is exactly the way to deploy capital.
But it also helps that you've made a bit of money.
It has always gone in the good category. Yes, luck is a good thing, I've always said.
So as a retailer, supply chain is probably our biggest challenge. And I'm sure this is the same for many industries. What new business models or technologies do you think are going to emerge as we face into this challenge?
Well, I would say, first of all, you're quite right to focus on technology and innovation. We have always thought that innovation and technology and sustainability are basically linked. And the journey that we've been on over the course of the last 5 to 10 years has really been the melding of sustainability, innovation, and entrepreneurship, including, by the way, business leaders in existing businesses recognizing this change and the drive for innovation. So that has to continue. And I think it very much will because the opportunity is extraordinary across multiple industries. But there are other tools that I think you're referring to that we will need to develop. And one of it is really understanding the role of impact. So all businesses, all investment has impact. But we've historically more or less ignored that. And ultimately, what we're hearing from our clients is that they are going to expect that we're going to report on risk, return, and impact. And so the answer to your question is we're going to have to get much better at measuring impact and understanding the challenges of a supply chain, for example. There are a handful of initiatives, including, by the way, the Sustainable Accounting Standards Boards, the TCFD from a climate perspective. There's the Impact Measurement Project that is being led in this country, actually, by a number of thoughtful people. These will be tools to help answer that. And so asset owners and asset managers will go to folks such as yourself and say, look, here's what we need to know about your business. And that will, you'll say, well, actually, that's impossible. And here's what I can tell you. And we'll have a discussion on how that's going to evolve. But people will have to run their businesses recognizing that impact can no longer be an externality, that we're going to have to recognize that those impacts will be measured and reported upon and acted upon.
Do you think it's up to governments to institutionalize some of this thinking? Or do you think that business can manage it given the transparency that is now offered?
Well, it's a great question. And it's one that seems to be getting more and more discussion and will do so. When we started our journey, we chose not to answer that question. We felt that business and capital markets had so far to go and had so much opportunity to assess the risks and the growth opportunities that innovation and new products and sort of the entrepreneurship of both established businesses and up-and-coming businesses would drive change. And indeed, that's happened. The whole question on decarbonizing the economy, whether it be energy, whether it be food, whether it be fashion, these issues and these industries and companies are changing very, very quickly. And it's because of great entrepreneurs and business leaders who are driving that change. And so we've come a long ways. I think we're worried, though, that the change that we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years, while extraordinary, isn't going to be enough. And so we're going to need transformational change, not incremental change. I think entrepreneurs and business leaders such as yourself will drive that change, but I think it would be naive to assume that we will do it without a price on carbon, for example, and increased regulation. So I'd like to say that capital markets and business and entrepreneurs will solve the problem of inequality as well as climate, and they indeed will be part of the solution. In fact, maybe the principal part of the solution, but so will government and so will civil society, and we need all three to work together.
I think that's really interesting. Of course, there are still people who say you can transfer impact and it just land somewhere else. So the argument that people make about electric cars, people make about palm oil, some of the biggest issues of our time that have been addressed, there's a counter argument that we just move the problem somewhere else. So how do business leaders grapple with this?
Well, going back to your question on regulation, I think that there will be regulation associated with that, but it will also be the asset owner and investment management community, the asset management community will, both publicly and privately, will help drive that question. When we started Generation, we had to ask the question, is sustainability in ESG permitted under law? Are you fulfilling your fiduciary duty if you're considering sustainability in ESG? And we, with some help of some thoughtful legal advice, realized that you could use that tool. And then we asked the question a few years on to say, well, actually, is sustainability and ESG, should it be required? Is it required by law? And it's now actually the law of the land. Governor Carney likes to say, what's your plan to net zero? That's the law of the land. That's what is going to happen. We're asking a new question today. We're asking a question of whether impact can be a criteria to allocate capital, both from a company perspective and an investment perspective. And we believe the answer is yes. We believe that fulfill your fiduciary duty, you must understand impact. But actually, that's not our ambition. Our ambition is to make impact the law of the land. And that if we really want to make capitalism address the challenges of climate and fairness and inequality, we're going to have to ensure that impact is required of business and the allocators of capital.
I think that's really interesting. I think there are few businesses who really understand that it won't be long before the carbon footprint of their customers will become their responsibility.
Yes. And they'll have to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
The one good thing about BP's announcement becoming net zero in 2050 is that they're taking responsibility for their product. That at least is a step in the right direction. It can be much faster and sooner and more robust, but that is a recognition to the point you were just saying, is that it will become all of our responsibility to understand holistically what it is that we're doing.
We're speaking at the time of coronavirus. How resilient and how innovative do you think human beings can be? And how close to the edge do they have to get to before they deploy their imagination?
That's a wonderful question, because we're going to need all of that innovation and then some to achieve our goals over the course of the next decade. And we really will need to start to imagine ways of doing business, ways of living our lives in sort of scenarios that we haven't currently imagined. And I think left to incremental change, we won't make it. I can't stress enough the urgency of our challenges right now. Of course, the virus is an urgent challenge. The climate crisis, we have basically 5 to 10 years to address it. If we don't get at it, it's over. We don't have 20 years or 30 years. It's 5 to 10 years. And that's why the linking of a just transition and climate is so critical that we get that right now. One of the things that stunned me earlier in the year is the fires in Australia. The temperature rise in 2019 in Australia as a continent was 1.5 degrees C higher than the last 100 years. So when we think about Paris, the goal we have set ourselves as people is that we will limit warming to no more than 1.5 degrees C. First of all, that's really going to be really, really hard. And those of us who make those statements then say, and everything's going to be fine. Well, it's not true. You just need to look at what's happening in Australia to see what a 1.5 degree C world looks like. And you know that that's terrible. And it's likely that we're going to find ourselves at something higher than that. And so the urgency of needing to move, I don't think business executives, I don't think we as people yet have fully embraced what we need to do. There's an expression that things take longer than you think they should and then move faster than you think they could. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen here.
Is it really possible to decouple growth from planetary and human impact?
That's a great question. And we wrestle with it. We think in the short term, the answer is yes. Because the transition to a no-carbon economy will be the most significant economic change and opportunity in history. It will touch everything. So there will be great growth opportunities, great business opportunities. The New Economy report said it's something like $26 trillion. I've heard Goldman Sachs say it's $50 trillion. These are big numbers, and who knows? But it's a big deal. The problem is that as we see winners and great new businesses and great business models, there will be significant losers. There will be significant stranded assets, significant stranding of both real estate assets, of carbon assets, and old business models. And so we might actually have a net zero growth. There'll be winners and losers in how we think about that, probably. But it's possible that we will, in the journey of measuring impact, begin to realize that unfettered capitalism is suboptimal. If we start pricing in externalities of communities, climate, and other charges on society, we may realize that actually what we thought was growth actually wasn't growth, and that we need to rethink about what our definition of growth is. So I think there's growth opportunities in the old traditional way, because the transition to a low carbon economy is going to be extraordinary. But we may also need to redefine what we mean by growth. And it may need to be much more holistic.
So what advice do you give to a leader who's faced with the fact that his impact or her impact is not wholly good or useful in society or for the planet? How are they going to even begin to unpick their supply chain, their business model, and how can they best bring their people along with them?
Right. It's a really critical question. And one thing's for sure, you can't basically say, well, because I said so. That works maybe with your children, but not even probably. And you can't really say, well, because it's just the right thing to do. It has to be more than that. It has to be, well, what is the business case? Why is this going to be a more robust way to do business, a more robust way to allocate capital? And the good news is the business models and the business case are robust. And you need to start with that. So why does it make sense to be a more thoughtful citizen in your community? Because the community will embrace you. Why does it make sense to pay a fair wage? Because people will want to work for your company. Why does it make sense to lower your carbon footprint? Because it will save you money. These are common sense points. And you just need to say, here's why we're doing it, and then measure it and establish it in very clear terms. And people will come on. People will come along because A, it's clear that this is where the world is going, and B, it's pretty much common sense.
So David, what piece of advice do you wish you'd been given before embarking on this journey?
Well, when we started our journey, I have to confess, we did not realize how hard it was going to be. We thought there were 7 founding partners, and we all thought that we would be successful. And we learned after 3 or 4 years how lucky we were. Timing was great. A lot of things that shouldn't have happened, happened. So we are a much humbler lot today than we were 16 years ago when we got started. And I think what probably the advice I would give to folks is, being an entrepreneur is really fun, but it's really hard, and you need to embrace that. And if you can help affect change and be part of a solution, and really, as we were talking in the very beginning, to bring together mission and purpose with commercial outcomes, it's really an invigorating business model. And we wouldn't change our experiences for anything in the world. I wouldn't want any job at Goldman Sachs versus the job I have now. This is great.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with David as much as I did. Please remember to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a review and share it with anyone you think might find this series valuable. This episode was brought to you by Selfridges Group and Radio Wolfgang. The producers were Eli Block and Holly Aquilina. The production manager was Katie Fuller, and the executive producer was Harry Watson. Thank you once again to David Blood. I'm Alana Weston, and this is How to Lead a Sustainable Business.